Welcome to the China Lab Podcast, publicizing current research on China. I'm Jeremy Wallace, your host. For this episode, I had the pleasure of talking with Jeff Wasserstrom about his new book, Eight Juxtapositions, China Through Imperfect Analogies from Mark Twain and Manchukuo. My guest is Chancellor's Professor in History at the University of California, Irvine. I hope that you enjoy our discussion. Welcome and thanks for joining me, Jeff.
Oh, it's my pleasure to do this.
So the book, Eight Juxtapositions, China Through Imperfect Analogies from Mark Twain and Manchukuo, provides, I think, in a short package, significant food for thought, pushing us away from unhelpful binaries, bulls or bears, reformer or conservative, that we often see in writings about China, towards nuance and complexity. And so I'm someone who is kind of sympathetic towards this idea. I'm a scholar of comparative politics, and on almost all of my syllabi, I have this quote from Rudyard Kipling, "What do they know of England who only England know?" And so I think that that kind of speaks to my belief in comparison. But at the same time, this idea of imperfect analogies or bad analogies, I think they can be dangerous and not just fail to illuminate, but kind of actively obscure realities. And so why do you find imperfect analogies, as you deem them, so useful? And how do you avoid pitfalls?
Well, I guess one thing I'd say is that I think people are always at least implicitly comparative when they're writing about historical issues and writing about political issues, in the sense that when we're writing about historical issues, in our minds is always how these are similar to or different from things going on now. And I think when we write about the present or think about the present, our minds often are dealing with analogies with things that have happened in the past. And similarly, when we're talking about China from the vantage point of the West, there's some kind of comparison going on in our minds between Western, the part of the West that we know best, probably, and China. So part of my goal in playing with analogies is to get these kind of comparative frames on the table directly and say that whether we're talking about parallels between the past and the present or between China and another place, the search for the perfect fit is not going to work. So the challenge is, what are some admittedly imperfect things that can help put things into a new light?
And so can you say something about how you avoid pitfalls there? In addition to the eight juxtapositions from the book, you have continued to follow this path. And there was some discussion online and a response that you had about comparing Xi Jinping today to Chiang Kai-shek. And so I wonder if you could say something about the ways in which you, like, are there comparisons or juxtapositions that you have thought about but decided ultimately are, you know, non-productive?
Sure. I think there often are ones. And usually when I'm inspired to come up with some sort of comparative angle, it's because there's another one floating around that I think is gaining traction and is somehow going to fool people into overlooking some of the things that are limitations to it. And by throwing another comparison into the mix, I think it helps to clarify. It's actually often using multiple analogies at the same time to play off of one another. And so for the example with Xi Jinping, there are a set of quite ready kinds of analogies that have come to hand. And you see it with things like The Economist having a cover image of him that shows him as dressed in Qing Dynasty robes. And there's an idea, and there are books out about him, but there were earlier ones about Deng and others called the New Emperors. And so there's a way of thinking about, okay, one way of thinking about Xi Jinping is as somebody who is a throwback to a dynastic moment. And Xi himself, to some extent, encourages that by his playing on Confucian ideas, which go back to the imperial moment, and also calling for his China dream is largely about China returning to a place of centrality in the world that it had before the so-called 100 years of humiliation of Western bullying. So that's one analogy that's out there with Xi Jinping that we sort of that's quite present in the discussions. there's another pair of them that are out there, which are thinking of Xi Jinping as a throwback to Deng Xiaoping. He's done certain things that are reminiscent of Deng, and there are references to him being like Mao. And all of those, I think, they can be useful up to a point, but there are limits to their usefulness. And I suggested in writing a short piece about thinking about the parallels between Xi Jinping and Chiang Kai-shek as a way to partly get out of that box. And partly, I think, the one reason to do that is that part of what's going on with Xi Jinping now, if you look at his place in the world, is he's presenting himself and being treated as a very normalized kind of leader. He's more and more taking on some of the trappings, and this has been true of the last couple of leaders before him, of certain kinds of leaders of Western countries. He's taking it a bit further with one kind of stylistic thing. He's now not only called president routinely, as his two predecessors were, even though his power is derived largely, one could say predominantly, by his leadership of the Communist Party, as opposed to his status as the titular head of state, the way the president is made to think. But he's traveling around with a stylish wife, who is sometimes referred to as China's first lady, which I think overlooks the fact that Chiang Kai-shek also had a prominent role for his stylish and articulate wife, Song Meiling, who went around and played a kind of a supplementary but important diplomatic role. So something about the two of them as a couple doesn't resonate with certainly any Qing parallel, and it doesn't resonate with Deng or with Mao in the way that that they worked in the kind of international diplomatic arena. So that's one kind of similarity that I think gets glossed over. And if we want to think about Xi's spouse, I think Chiang Kai-shek gets us further. But in another way, I think one of the key things about Xi's mode is this kind of extreme version of eclecticism, of throwing together elements from the symbolism, the revolutionary symbolism of the party that he leads, which is a kind of radical past and revolutionary past, combined with moves to revive Confucianism even more than his predecessors, though building on what his predecessors did. And this very odd kind of amalgamation of revolutionary and Confucian traditions. And I think that's something that we really need to think about seriously with Xi Jinping, and the place to find a parallel for that particular dynamic is with Chiang Kai-shek, who both claimed to be carrying forward the revolutionary tradition of Sun Yat-sen, who had this symbolic nod. He made nods back to him parallel to the nods that Xi makes back to Mao, for example. But at the same time, Chiang Kai-shek called for an embracing of Confucian values. He had the New Life Movement. He called for China to kind of double down on its traditions. And a book of his writings, a book of his kind of manifesto for this, China's Destiny, became an important text in China in the 1940s. And now Xi Jinping's writings are now being treated with a similar kind of reverence within contemporary China. So it's not that, I mean, you can poke holes in the Chiang Kai-shek analogy. It can't be taken too far. But I think for certain elements of the Xi, to making sense of what Xi's about, how he's seen in the world, what his place is, that there is something to be gained from that that takes us places that the other analogies more commonly floated don't take us.
And I think that argument makes a lot of sense, and it's not the only comparison to Xi that we'll talk about, because the book has another one that I think is perhaps more imperfect, but also, because it is a very different perspective, sheds light in a different way. And that actually gets to a question that I had, which is that the book, when I the title of the book is Eight Juxtapositions, and this idea came to my mind, well, how do you structure a book that is eight comparisons? And I'm impressed by the way that the book does so, which is essentially by time. And so I wonder if that was always in your mind, that idea that rather than how do you kind of order, well, I'm going to compare Tibet to Manchukuo and the Orwell and Huxley. How do I order these things in terms of chapters and flow? And the book does so through time, and I wonder if that idea was always there.
Well, the idea wasn't always there, because this is the second book I've done that I call an accidental book. I wasn't setting out to write it by any means. And I had an earlier book, China's Brave New World and Other Tales for Global Times, that mm-hmm. emerged in a similar fashion. And this is, in a way, a sequel to that. China's Brave New World and Other Tales for Global Times was a book that Indiana University Press brought out in 2007. And so after my first book, which was about student protests in Shanghai from 1911 to 1949, that was an intentional book, my Shanghai student protest book. It was based on a dissertation, kind of a classic first book. You write a dissertation, you revise it into a book. In that book, one of the things I did was I dealt with events in Shanghai, but I didn't really deal with Shanghai as a city. So I wanted my second book to be this book that was really about Shanghai as a global city through time. And I took an incredibly long time writing it. My first book came out quickly, 2 years after the PhD in 1991. My global Shanghai book, which went through all kinds of permutations, in part because I had a plan of writing a book about Shanghai that came up to the present, and Shanghai's present kept changing so dramatically in unexpected ways.
Yeah.
When I started writing or thinking about global Shanghai in the mid to late 90s, there was this idea that the theme of it was going to be that Shanghai had been a great global city, one of the world's great cosmopolitan hubs, and just a major exciting place in the late 1800s through early 1900s. And it was striving to somehow regain that kind of centrality after a period of turning inward under Mao, but it just wasn't going to achieve anything like the global prominence and excitement that it had in that earlier period, was my projection or prediction. Right. One reason I try to steer clear of predictions since then. And by the late 1990s, early 21st century, it was clear that was the wrong frame, that actually even though there were some elements of that earlier Shanghai moment that were not being re-achieved or regained and still haven't been regained, Shanghai is not a great center of publishing and art in the way it was in that period, because there's too much control. But in some of the things like, you know, amazing architecture that brought together elements from different parts of the world, there is something of that there again. So the story became a more complex one about there being a lot of hype to this idea of the return of Shanghai or the reglobalization of Shanghai, but yet there was also some reality to it. And so the book took a long time to write. And so while I was still plugging away at it and straining the patience of a very patient press and series editor, Mark Selden, who had commissioned the book, I realized that I had a series of kind of occasional writings of short pieces for magazines and newspapers. This was mostly pre the blog era. And mm-hmm. I realized that what I had seen as these kinds of writings as being very fringe to my kind of real job were some of the things I was most passionate about. And I gave a talk based on one of them at Indiana University, and a press, an editor from the press was there and said, why don't you turn that into a book? And I said, it was about bookstores and the way what was for sale in bookstores had changed so dramatically in ways that would have mystified Mao if he'd come back to life mm-hmm. and seen that you could buy these guides to starting your own bar or cafe in a still purportedly communist country. And I told her, well, you know, there's not a book in that. That's a short piece. But I've got about, you know, a dozen of those, and maybe there'd be some way to pull those together into a volume. And so those came out as a volume. And then flashing forward from there, I kept doing that kind of writing. I didn't stop in 2007 when that book came out. And so I've now been working on another intentional book that's taking longer than I expected and straining the patience of a very patient editor and press. I'm working on a book on the Boxer Uprising and the foreign invasion of 1900. And I realized that once again, while working away at that big book, there might be a little book of occasional pieces to pull together. And so I broached this idea actually with a former student of mine, Chen Mengfei, who's now working with Penguin in China. And she said, well, have you thought about, we've got this little series of Penguin specials, which are very short books. And maybe, even though those tend to be about one theme and kind of a single long essay, maybe a set of these short commentaries could work there. And so I wasn't setting out to do a set of comparative commentaries, but I realized that nearly all of the commentaries that I liked the best and thought had worked best, in this case, written almost exclusively for online venues of various kinds, that they all involved some kind of juxtaposition, either a comparison or an analogy, or in occasional cases, an effort to reject a comparison or analogy or a binary. And so that, working then with another editor at Penguin, who gave, I think I sent her originally 10 or 12 short pieces, and I showed them to a few friends, and they said, these work better than those. And then eventually it just shook down to 8. And it was that point I realized there was about one per year. And then I structured it at that point around one per year to take what I'm beginning to feel more and more is a kind of significant breaking point. 2008 with the Olympics, I think certainly in terms of China's place in the world and international thinking about China, that moment of seeing fireworks go off above a state-of-the-art stadium and Hu Jintao welcoming world leaders, Putin and Bush, among others, to Beijing and greeting them with a quotation from Confucius. And then at the same time, you know, this, anyway, it was, transformative and important moment. And so it seemed a natural starting point.
I guess there's two questions I have there. One is about timing, in the sense that the essays about the Olympics or about the Shanghai Expo in 2010, to what extent are those your thoughts today versus your thoughts kind of then, or kind of shaped by those moments? And then second, the book ends, it can't go into the future. And do you think that if it begins at a particular moment, do you think that we are at another particular moment today? Or is it just the idea that you have enough of these that it's a book? Or do you think that 2015, 2016 will be thought of as another turning point in China?
Well, that's a great question. And first I'll say, the most daring thing I did in that Shanghai book, Global Shanghai 1850 through 2010, was to end the book, daring for a historian, end the book a year after the book was actually published. Because I knew that for better or worse, the expo would be a kind of important moment and seemed like an endpoint. Yeah, I have no idea whether we're in the middle of something, the end of something. I really don't know, and don't want to go on record about that. Mm-hmm. I think we're so regularly wrong when we do venture into this sort of hard-edged prediction. I think it's an interesting moment right now, a worrisome moment right now, but whether it's the start, whether it's midway through a worrying period or near the end of a worrying period, I really don't know. So 2008 made sense as a starting point. Mm-hmm. I don't know if 2015, when I put the commentaries to bed, will make sense as an end point. Each of the pieces was written, well, except for the Xi Jinping and the Pope piece, which was written in 2015. And I guess the Hugh Hua and Mark Twain piece was the one complete anomaly in this sense, that I wrote it in 2015, but it was something I had been thinking about in a certain way since 2012. Most of the others were written at a moment in time, 2008, 2009, and so on, marching up through the period. And then when I put the volume together and tweaked, all the essays were tweaked to some extent. Mm-hmm. And I also did some updating in differing ones. So the Orwell and Huxley go to the World's Fair, or using the Shanghai Expo to think about the 1984 versus Brave New World paradigm, which I've thought about a lot, and the need to see China as having elements of both of those dystopian visions. It draws on things I was thinking about when I walked around the fairgrounds in 2010. I then kept mulling those ideas, published the piece in 2011, what was then the brand newly founded Los Angeles Review of Books, where a lot of these pieces first appeared. And then when I was writing about it to smooth the edges of it and update it in 2015, I kept the basic bones of the piece dealing with the expo in there, but I slipped in a couple of things that I had thought about later, for example, or that it happened later.
Right.
For example, in that I mentioned that if we want to think about the kind of soft authoritarian of Huxley, materialist consumerism without the kind of boot on the face Orwellian side of the state, we could think about Hong Kong as being part of the People's Republic of China that was most on the Brave New World side of the spectrum, as opposed to the 1984 side of the spectrum. And places like Xinjiang and Tibet, the 1984 structures of control, the boot on the face, the big brother is watching you, they fit into that much more. And then the mainland, most other places, especially cities, there was a mix between Brave New World in 1984. But then I was thinking about, you know, Hong Kong had begun to move into another phase. There are different things had been happening. And while I didn't want to slip in a whole mini essay on the umbrella movement or anything like that, I thought it was worth noting that the fact that there was such outrage when tear gas was used against the umbrella protesters, the fact that local people said, how can something like this be happening, was a sign that unlike in some other parts of the PRC, that kind of nakedly boot on the face style of control was something that would shock rather than would be seen as kind of, well, of course that's going to happen. So that became something that I thought was logical to mention there to underscore how at that earlier point, the Brave New World style of authoritarian control was the rule in Hong Kong, but that there might be moves at least toward a mix of the kind of 1984 and Brave New World now in Hong Kong.
And that essay, I think, is, I also am drawn to that juxtaposition, the Orwell and Huxley juxtaposition about the ways in which authoritarian regimes kind of rule, and the phrase, the great expression that you have, the idea of watching people versus what people watch, how do states control their populations, I think is really significant and important. And the internal variation that you just highlighted between, I think this gets at the idea that there is not necessarily a China story, but many stories within China, and that realization or kind of acknowledgement of the variation within China is really important to that. And I wonder to what extent you think that the consumption and escapism of consumerism is something that the regime is happy to encourage. And how do you think about external environments or the ways in which the regime kind of points towards the world? When you talk about escapism, often I'm thinking about kind of fantastical worlds or science fiction or Harry Potter, what have you. But there is also this idea that the external world, in terms of foreign policy, that the Chinese regime can escape attention because of its kind of foreign meanderings.
Yeah, no, I think there's I think thinking about distraction and spectacle is something that maybe we need to figure out a better way to bring into discussions of things like international relations and foreign affairs. I mean, I think it's because I do think this, you know, culture of the spectacle is not something that is distinctive to China. And I think what any one state can get away with doing has a lot to do with what else is going on in the world. We're in a period of kind of, you know, constant distraction and toggling between paying attention to different places. And so while to some extent spectacles can be used within a country to distract attention, there's also a way that spectacles in other places distract attention. I mean, on Twitter, I mentioned that I had just done a podcast with Devin Stewart from Carnegie that was talking about human rights issues in China and what I view as very disturbing trends just right now with things like the seizing of the booksellers in the Hong Kong booksellers and the crackdown on lawyers and NGOs and all this going on in China. And one person wrote back on Twitter, you know, ha ha, nobody's going to care about that right now. The story is Trump. And, you know, you're just not going to get any traction was the implication for talking about human rights abuses, probably in any place when so much attention in the United States is being paid to our own very worrisome spectacle involving a figure who people in many parts of the non-democratic world would recognize quite well, a kind of macho strongman playing to the call to make the country great again. I think, you know, if I were redoing a book of juxtapositions now, there would be a temptation, certainly, when talking about figures, some of the aspects of figures like Xi Jinping and Putin. Putin's another person I say is an imperfect analogy for Xi, but with certain things worth thinking about, there's a pattern of elements going on there that you can see in Trump as well. Again, not that that's who he's just like, but there are a set of characteristics. We had a roundtable at the last Association for Asian Studies meeting on strongmen leaders of Asia and talking about what figures like Modi in India, Abe in Japan, Xi Jinping in China, and so forth had in common. And it seemed that even though, of course, there were very big differences, some of these were elected leaders, some not, that there were some patterns that you could find. And, you know, at the time, it didn't seem normal to bring an American case into that. But there certainly have been in the past and is now a way in which you could make that kind of argument, bringing it in there. And as you've worked so well on popular nationalism, you know that isn't just something that is a China story, though it has particular elements when there is the state encouraging loyalist expressions or playing to kind of jingoistic sentiments. But that's something that happens in many other places as well.
It's true. And yet at the same time, there is something to be said for the arrests of these booksellers is that it is not something that is happening in the middle of the night and no one knows exactly what is happening, that there have been these televised confessions, which seem to kind of fit somewhere in between these two, this Huxley and Orwell idea that there is, we are going to distract you with the reality of the Orwellian state in which we live, or distract you with the reality of the power of our state control. And that seems very different from of foreign adventurism or diversion in kind of a classical way.
Sure. Yeah. And I think this is actually right. This is interesting because, I mean, it's very hard to sort of wrap the mind around, the confessions and the televised ones. I did really like, there was a piece in the Washington Post that talked about how the confessions that were being made, presumably with coercion behind them, were telling stories that didn't really add up. There were a lot of logical gaps and things. And in fact, with one of the confessions, what seemed to be one confession, the confessor, his shirt changes midway through. So obviously these are You know, and Emily Ruhala, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing her name right, but as a journalist, I'm finding very, 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 very engaging to read lately. She said that part of the message might have been the incoherence and the irrationality and the fact that things didn't add up, because what the spectacle in that case was really showing to people watching on television wasn't that this was, you know, this was reality, but rather this is what the state can do if you anger them so much. They can get you to, in a sense, say anything, which is a quintessentially Orwellian mode of control. Because in 1984, one of the things is if the state tells you 2 + 2 = 5, you have to say 2 + 2 = 5. So that's a great example. I'll have to use that when next time I, because I endlessly revisit this Orwell Huxley thing, that television, or you know, this kind of, we often think of things like television and films as fitting into the Huxley side of this with the kind of what you're watching, but that would be an example of how it's used to an Orwellian rather than Huxleyan purpose.
One could go into so many details here because the book really does emphasize the nuances. It attacks, I think, helpfully the boxes in which we find ourselves or we find our thinking. So the endless essays about is she a real reformer or a real conservative, or is what who is really a dissident, and are authors or writers or artists who produce work in China, do they have to be dissidents, and what does it mean to be a dissident? I think there's really great kind of material in the book kind of trying to blow up those distinctions, and the kind of incorporation of Mark Twain in that I thought was quite interesting. And so I wonder if you could say something about the ways in which your childhood kind of interest in Mark Twain, or continued interest in Mark Twain, but from early origins, kind of wormed its way into your thinking about the ways in which we think about Chinese dissidents and the ways in which artists interact with states.
Yeah, I'm pretty, there are certain kind of tells, I suppose, with me, things that I'm obsessed with, and so if I can find the excuse to bring them into writing, I will, and Mark Twain is one. Well, with that, there was a whole debate when Mo Yan won the Nobel Prize about whether this was scandalous, as some people said, that here was an official writer of the state. He was you know, co-chairman of the Official Writers Association, being rewarded by this international body. And then others responding, well, no, actually, if you read Mo Yan carefully, you find that he's pretty subversive. He's mocking officials and things like this. And there was this was an example of these, I think, unhelpful binaries of assuming that the only two categories that Mo Yan could fit into was a stooge, a kind of you know, somebody doing the state's bidding, or a dissident, somebody attacking the state. And there was some very good writing about the limits of that discussion and the peculiarity of that being the way the debate about Mo Yan was largely carried out, as opposed to, as what happens with many other Nobel Prize winners from other parts of the world, simply, how good a writer is he? How, you know, how powerful is the work? I mean, there was some blending of that in the discussions, but you really felt that the people who wanted to argue for the quality of his writing were emphasizing his subversiveness, and the people who wanted to argue that he wasn't that good a writer were sliding into playing up also his loyalism. So people like Pankaj Mishra tried to say, why is this the litmus test that we use for some writers but not others? And that got me thinking about Mark Twain, who I've thought about a lot as a more complex writer than he's imagined to be by those who just associate him with Tom Sawyer and Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn and things like that. I've been intrigued. I mean, I loved Mark Twain before I got that interested in China, but I was then fascinated by the fact that Mark Twain was really interested in China throughout much of his adult life. And he wrote an op-ed actually at one point about the unfairness of the treaty port system, the unequal treaties being foisted on China. He was very interested in the experience of Chinese Americans and Chinese immigrant labor. he almost went to China, though through a fluke he never ended up going there, even though he traveled around so much of the world. But then, with this Boxer project I've been reading, he wrote scathing indictments of missionary activities in China and the hypocrisy of Western imperialism, and he was a leading anti-imperialist in the U.S. And so, when thinking about Mark Twain and imagining, well, what if he had won the Nobel Prize? He didn't, but what if he had? You could have the same debate that you had about Mo Yan. I mean, in many ways, he was an establishment figure. He hobnobbed with rich and powerful people in America, and then some of his writings were not very political. But then, on the other hand, he wrote these scathing indictments of certain elements of American policy and things like that. But nobody would have thought that that was the discussion you should have about Mark Twain. So I could bring Mark Twain into this poking a hole in this kind of binary about Mo Yan, and then but also as a way of when Mo Yan won the prize, one of the things that I thought was too bad it wasn't Hu Hua, because I just prefer Hu Hua as a writer. And then I realized with Hu Hua, though I think I not only prefer him as a writer, but I also think his politics are more interesting and more daring, that he doesn't just poke, he doesn't just skewer what are the kind of acceptable things to skewer, like the corruption of local officials, but he calls into question more basic things about the narratives that the Chinese state likes to tell. And so I thought bringing Mo Yan and Hu Hua together was a way of saying that it's not that this binary is problematic, in part because you overlook a spectrum that runs from somebody who's more toward the loyalist side with subversive elements to somebody who does a bit more of the subversion but still has loyalist elements. Hu Hua still is a member of the Official Writers Association and things like that. And then the more that set me thinking, some of this, as you can tell, is like chains of association. I started thinking, well, do Hu Hua and Mark Twain have anything else in common besides the fact that they wrote more politically charged nonfiction, because Hu Hua writes these commentaries that can only be published abroad usually, and has this kind of pointed social and political critic side like Mark Twain. And then I started just thinking about the two authors as authors, the kind of way of thinking about where did they find their material, what kinds of things did they write, and I found some interesting parallels there that I think for both of them, some of their best novels are about boyhood in a place away from the kind of major metropolitan centers, and they both deal with a coming of age at a time when their country was torn up in differing ways. Because for Mark Twain, the Civil War, and for Hu Hua, the Cultural Revolution, and so not, and they're both funny writers, which I think is important. There's a kind of humor combined with fascination with the everyday, and then occasionally this kind of politically charged commentary, which is probably not that common a combination of elements for a writer.
I want to get close to wrapping up because there are so many things that I could ask about, and I do recognize that we have to move on, but there is something I have to talk about, which is the final comparison, the final chapter, the final juxtaposition between the Pope, who is perhaps not someone that everyone would think about, and the extent to which you, at the beginning of this our conversation, you mentioned the idea of Xi as a very eclectic leader, pulling together different pieces. And this essay emphasizes the idea that this is not just a Chinese phenomenon or just something that happens, that there are complicated histories that the Catholic Church has with different historical thinkers. And you talk about Raphael's School of Athens in particular as fitting along these lines.
Yeah, and I mean that was an example of an analogy that came to my mind at one time, and then had a very different. I wrote a very short thing about that just when Xi Jinping and the Pope were being anointed. I wrote a short piece about that, and then actually traveling, which inspires a lot of this kind of writing, and actually going to the Vatican during what was largely a family trip, sparked a new kind of appreciation for an element of that. So the original notion of comparing them was very simple. I was they came to power at virtually the same moment. I mean, Xi Jinping was made head of the Chinese Communist Party in November of 2012, but he was the second part of his ascension that completed the ascension was in March 2013, which was the same time that Pope Francis took over. And it was just very curious to me. And it might have just made a kind of opening joke for a talk as opposed to anything more than that, or a very short blog post, that when I was in China, jet lagged, flipping through television news in different languages, which is what I do when I can't sleep, when I've just arrived in China, I realized sort of nodding in and out that the news always seemed to be about the new leader of 1.2 or 1.3 billion people who'd been chosen through a secretive process involving a group of old men, and was going to take power when his predecessor, would the predecessor be looking over his shoulder or fade from view, was a question, and would he be able to handle this big scandal or corruption issue that was plaguing the massive organization that he ran. And I realized that this set of things, it was hard to tell unless you listened carefully or fully woke and looked at what scenes were being showed, whether they were talking about Zhongnanhai or Vatican City, whether they were talking about Francis or Xi. So that's the kind of thing. These are two organizations, the Catholic Church and the Chinese Communist Party, that aren't routinely thought of as parallel or similar and so forth. And yet there were these set of similarities. Now, I wasn't the first person to think of there being some parallels there. There have been discussions by others from political science and from journalism who've talked about certain elements, including kind of propaganda wings. These are two groups that at least for much of their history, haven't been ashamed about saying that part of their goal is propaganda, to propagate a set of ideas and to try to persuade. Now the propaganda departments in China are sometimes saying, well, call us the communications department. But for a long time, propaganda was accepted there. There have been others who've talked about the secretiveness of certain things and so forth. But it was going then to Rome with this in the back of my mind, and then going to the Vatican and seeing the School of Athens, which is a fascinating painting that I just had not really been aware of before, not having done art history. I knew about the Sistine Chapel. I didn't know about this right before then. And what's interesting to me about that painting is it shows a set of thinkers from pre-Christian times who are being presented as great thinkers, the Plato, Aristotle, and so forth. And then it also combines them with Renaissance figures in the painting. It's a very, very interesting work. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've always tried to be on watch for, but I think sometimes you can slip into letting your guard down, I think we all do, is trying not to overly exoticize something going on in China, make it seem too much like something that wouldn't or couldn't happen in another part of the world. And one of the things that I fell into that trap with, I think, was the founding of Confucius Institutes and the veneration of Confucius by an ostensibly still communist Marxist organization. And when I talked about the Confucius Institutes, which make me nervous for many reasons before, I'd said this is so hard to imagine a parallel to, because, you know, it's not as though, I mean, imagine the Soviet Union, while the Communist Party was still in power, naming its kind of cultural wing after a figure who was seen as dangerous and subversive by that same organization at an earlier time, just because it was a famous Russian figure from the past. But seeing the School of Athens did remind me that there were periods in the history of Catholicism where some of the writings of Aristotle, for example, would be seen as things that were dangerous and subversive, or that represented something before and definitely outside of the stream of what the Catholic Church was about, and that here you could have in this very sacred space something where that figure was shown in a positive light, and that there was something went on over time with the Catholic Church trying to absorb kind of all of the braggable elements of this kind of grand Western tradition and smoothing over some of the tensions there might be between doctrine and some parts of that tradition. And that, I think, provides a kind of normalization of what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing lately in trying to gather together, and we saw this in the Olympic opening ceremony as well as in some other things, this idea of being able to present itself as representing whatever could be thought of positively from this very many-stranded Chinese tradition.
And so it truly being a Chinese Communist Party rather than just a Communist Party,
right.
and being representative of that, the entirety of that tradition. So I hope and wish that everyone were as productive coming up with extra books as they are finishing other ones. So I look forward to that next big book, but hope and recommend everyone read this little one, which was quite a fun read. So thanks so much for joining me and talking.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for listening to another China Lab podcast. And thanks also to our producer, Austin Jordan. To hear all of our episodes, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast technology of choice. Our website is thechinalab.wordpress.com. If you'd like to get in touch, email me at wallace@cornell.edu or find me on Twitter @thechinalab.